This is Darcy Ungaro, and welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast. Whether it's in property, Bitcoin, shares, or business, this is a show designed to equip the everyday Kiwi make better investment decisions. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast is brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. Please remember, none of this is financial advice. We hope you enjoy the show. Hey, it's your host, Darcy Ungaro, and today we have Simeon Burnett in the studio with us. He's going to talk to us about how the NZ Everyday Investor can share in the success of startups and how equity crowdfunding works. Now, New Zealand is fertile ground for startups. Easy ones that you might know are Xero and TradeMe, but some of the newer ones like Archipro, Ubco, Invivo, Karmacola, to name just a few, are ones that you may not be aware of yet. Now, as a retail investor, normally the first entry point into participation in the success of Kiwi firms occurs when the company is eventually listed on a public exchange. But what if you wanted to get in on the ground floor? What if Rod Drury offered you an opportunity to invest in his wacky idea of a cloud-based software service back in 2006? If you're more of a sophisticated wholesale or eligible investor, this isn't new, and you could have already been playing in this space for quite some time. But now, via equity crowdfunding, there's an opportunity for everyday investors to share in some of the success too. Democratization of investing. This trend isn't going away, and there's a few businesses in New Zealand at the pointy head of this movement. Snowball Effect is one of them. So I'm pretty excited to have Simeon in the studio today. Sit down and enjoy the show. So welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor. Simeon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Darcy.
So Simeon, what would you describe yourself as?
Yeah, so we describe ourselves as a private equity marketplace, and that's quite a broad term. But private equity really is the concept of being able to invest directly through an online platform into private companies. Okay. So we're not talking about private equity, the asset class, but more the, as I say, the concept of investing directly into private companies.
Right.
And I think, you know, if you look at the New Zealand capital markets, there's actually a very small spectrum of companies within New Zealand that you can invest as a director directly into.
Okay.
You compare us to, say, Singapore or Ireland or, you know, countries of similar population, and a far greater number of their companies are publicly listed.
Right.
In terms of a proportion.
Okay.
Which means, you know, whether investors, whether they're sophisticated or not, have a far greater pool of companies to invest directly in.
Overseas,
right. Yes.
So in New Zealand, we're a little bit less mature in that space?
It just hasn't developed as much. You know, we're very much funds in terms of where investment flows go. So whether you're talking about investment banks and what they're offering their clients, tends to be funds under management. You sort of move down the chain to private equity. You know, they are obviously funds that are investing into companies. They move further south all the way down to angel type funding, so very early stage, seed stage investment. And again, it's quite often funds under management, funds that are investing into these companies with maybe the opportunity for some people to invest alongside those funds.
Right, but it's quite rare, or it has been quite rare, to have a direct access to these companies for investors to directly go and get a piece of the action.
That's right, and I think particularly if, you know, angel type investment is not quite your gig. It's a bit high risk, but you're still wanting to back a company that is growing quickly, has some long-term prospects for capital growth and capital appreciation. So yeah, that's the opportunity that we see. So that's sort of back to your original question. That's why we describe ourselves as a private equity marketplace. It's being able to invest directly into companies.
Right, because you do have a crowdfunding license.
Correct.
And you were one of the first, if not the first, to be granted a crowdfunding license?
Yeah, so we were the first platform to launch with a crowdfunding license in New Zealand. So that was mid-2014.
Yeah.
I guess we've evolved fairly significantly since then.
Right.
And I guess just to clarify what a crowdfunding license or an equity crowdfunding license actually allows,
yes, please,
people to do and us to do. So for companies, it allows them to come through our platform and make an offer of shares to the public. So outside of going through a full-blown IPO process, that's the only way that they can make an offer to the public. So they can raise up to $2 million from retail investors every 12 months,
right,
if they come through us. They can raise more than that from wholesale investors. Yes. So people that have experience or wealth, which means that they fall into a different category of investor type. So that got us going, and that got us into the capital markets here in New Zealand, and is a great way for people to invest in earlier stage, higher risk companies in New Zealand.
Going back to that crowdfunding bit, for our listeners who might not be familiar with the difference between, say, crowdfunding and just regular direct investment in a startup.
Yes.
Can you just explain why this whole crowdfunding thing has come about? What makes it different? You know, startups have access, more access to capital, but also investors have direct asset. Is that really all it is? It's just a simpler way of getting capital into those businesses and providing opportunities for investors?
Correct. Yeah. So I would say it's a more relevant way for people to invest these days, and probably a simpler way in a lot of respects for companies to raise capital from a wider audience. You'll have groups like Kickstarter that most people are familiar with, and that's all about donations. So you're effectively providing a company with a working capital fund to produce some widgets, and they'll send you that widget hopefully in 9 months' time or whatever it is. So you're an early user of that product, but you don't have an equity stake. You don't have shares in that company. You don't benefit if it goes well. You just have the product.
Right.
So equity crowdfunding, whilst it's got a very similar name to just crowdfunding, they're actually very different things. So equity crowdfunding really spawned out of the GFC. It really originated out of the UK. They were the first to create regulation around this asset class. And because a lot of capital, traditional capital channels had dried up for companies, they needed to explore other channels for raising capital. Okay. So the government there created regulation, which allowed them to go through a licensed platform. So groups like Cedars in the UK would be an example of that, where they could raise capital from a wider audience, a wider group of people. So it might be the customers, it might be end users, that sort of thing. So,
do you think it's like an evolution, or is it an alternative?
I think it's an alternative. I think what we've seen in the UK, and now that we're starting to see here, is that it's just another avenue, another channel for companies to raise capital from. In the UK, where they have a far more developed venture capital market, you're starting to see venture capital groups invest in some of these companies that are going through an equity crowdfunding round. So they may come in for, say, the first £1 million, and then £500,000 is made available to the public for whatever reason.
Right.
And there's some companies that that's suitable for in terms of making a public offer, and there's some companies that aren't. So, you know, part of our role as Snowball Effect is to work with companies to help devise a capital raising strategy. And then put that strategy to the investors that they're wanting to raise capital from.
Because those investors would like to know whether or not there's going to be debt as well, and whether there'll be other forms of financing also, right?
Correct. So I guess the process that we take companies through is very similar for each raise that we do. A portion of those raises will end up in the public arena for people to be able to invest, you know, as little as $1,000 in. So there's quite a low entry price for people. Others will be more focused on, hey, we want a strategic investor. We want, you know, one or two people writing large checks for various reasons. It might be commercial reasons. It might be they, you know, just want quite a small cap table. There's a bunch of reasons why different companies will go to different audiences for raising capital. And it can be a combination of those. It's not sort of one or the other.
So it's very much, it kind of feels like you're lubricating entrepreneurs, you're helping them to go through the process faster, get access to capital, which otherwise would restrict them. Now they have faster access to it. Is that something that's actually a trend? And are companies able to grow faster as a result of this? Or is this just taking business away from other sources, other traditional sources of like VC funding and private equity?
Yeah, I think in New Zealand, it's reasonably well publicized, but, you know, we have probably a fairly developed angel scene, you know, compared to, say, Australia, just as one example. You know, we're actually quite well developed in New Zealand. It's reasonably well connected. And, you know, there's a number of different angel groups throughout the country. So that's for very early stage funding. It can be seed stage through to probably companies doing, generally speaking, but say $1 million in revenue. Once you get north of there, if you are in the US or if you are in the UK, you would get venture capital firms starting to invest into those sorts of companies. In fact, in many cases, they will have gone earlier and just will take a company through its various stages of growth and the capital funding that's attached to that. But in New Zealand, we don't really have a venture capital scene. So there's a couple of venture capital funds, kind of, you know, Punakaiki Fund. Lance has been in here. And
that's right. Yeah, and that was they actually went through capital raising through you guys as well.
We did actually raise some capital. I think we've raised, I'm going to say, $3.5 million or something for their fund.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're a player in the market.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reality is that even if you look across sort of Punakaiki, a couple of other funds, such as Movac or Global from day one, you know, you're still talking, you know, south of a couple of $100 million.
Yeah.
That is floating around that market. And I guess that's sort of the space that we like to play in. And in fact, you know, if I look at the work that we do with investors in terms of what industries and stages and sectors and all that sort of stuff that they like to invest in, kind of companies doing north of sort of $3 million is really where people's interest start to get peaked. And I think, you know, that matches quite well to where that opportunity is in the New Zealand market.
Right.
So sort of all the way up to what I'd say pre-private equity.
Right.
And also what's happened in New Zealand over the last 5 or 7 years is that the private equity funds have raised larger and larger funding pools. So when they create a fund and they're doing Fund 4 or Fund 5 or whatever it is, those funds are getting larger. But they're still only going to invest in, you know, 8 to 10 companies per fund.
Right.
So it means that the companies that they're looking for are larger because they've got a larger check to deploy. So that gap to a degree has been getting wider, not smaller.
Yeah.
And we've seen as a trend across global capital markets that companies are staying private for longer. You know, there's been a dearth of IPOs, not just in New Zealand, but, you know, across a number of OECD nations.
Yeah.
So companies staying private for longer sort of feeds what I was saying earlier about less direct investment opportunities for people.
Right. So why do you think, Simi, why do you think that there is that dearth of IPOs? What's going on there? Like, why isn't there that progression through that way of, you know, raising capital anymore or as much as there used to be?
Sure. I think a lot of it has to do with liquidity, and I want to talk about the New Zealand market. Liquidity in the New Zealand market, you know, the NZX have tried a number of different exchanges to suit smaller businesses. Sort of less rules, less regulation to a degree around what they need to be doing. But there hasn't been the liquidity in those companies. The brokers don't cover them. So the analysts at the investment banks don't cover those firms because they're quite small.
Yes.
As a result of the lack of coverage, they're not being recommended to the investment advisors to put people into or put into some of their funds.
Right.
So there's just not that natural liquidity there. So outside of, you know, probably the top 50 really, and that's probably a moot point, there's limited liquidity because of the structure of the market and some of the regulatory aspects. So
do you think that trend's actually going to continue? Do you think that, again, maybe that what you guys are in, the space that you're involved in, is more of an evolution of the way that a lot of companies start raising capital because it's just too difficult doing it the traditional way?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we'll see over time is kind of more of a global capital market. I think that what we'll see is the NZX become a stepping stone to other markets.
Yeah.
So we've seen Xero, right? You know, they IPO'd a you know, pre-revenue company back in 2007, which was, you know, relatively unheard of in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And they've sort of got to the point now where they're listing on the ASX for a whole bunch of different reasons. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, like with Snowball Effect, we see ourselves as a stepping stone to a company that may be bought out by private equity. It might be acquired from an offshore strategic investor, an offshore company, or it may go through to an IPO. So we're sort of a stepping stone to something else.
An enabler.
That's right.
A true enabler. That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
Give them a taste of it, and then they just keep coming back. In a good way. You're raising funds from retail investors. You're giving them access to a bigger pool of funds of other investors, and then that effectively is the fund, which then gets passed on to another crowd, which then invests directly in startups and help them to go to the next stage. It's kind of like a production line, so to speak, isn't it? A funding production line. Is that a fair way of saying?
Yeah, that's right. There's sort of different risk appetites along the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, like private equity firms, they'll, you know, have a lot of institutional cash backing them.
Right.
And that's, you know, rightly or wrongly, that's because of institutional cash has a risk appetite, and that's kind of where it kicks in. And they're like, yeah, we're comfortable with that. We're not comfortable earlier on.
Yeah.
So right. You need people that are happy to have that earlier stage risk and
puts a container around the risk and protects the next stage of funding from that. Effectively, they're interested in the ride, but only in a certain aspect of the journey.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, those groups will have a mandate in terms of what they can and can't invest in.
Yes.
And it's about sort of finding homes for the cash that makes up, you know, a portion of their portfolio.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of the way that Snowball Effect started out, were you one of the founders or did you come along?
Yes, yeah. There was four of us. Okay. So there was myself, there was Richard Allen, Francis Reed, and Joshua Daniel.
Okay.
And we kicked it off. And
and what was that like? Was that kind of a pretty scary thing, being on the other side of that?
No, it was really interesting because we were working with MB, who, you know, write the regulation in effect, and the FMA oversee it. So we're licensed by the FMA.
Mm. So you were very much like a test case almost, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. So we did a bit of work early on. So this is obviously before we launched, but looking at people's attitudes and appetite, if you like, for what we were thinking of doing. Yeah. And we were feeding that back through to MB, who were interested because, you know, they're sort of sitting there and they have to write some regulation and that regulation kind of has to make sense in terms of the market needs to work and they don't want to throttle it before it starts and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sort of being involved in those discussions really early on, everyone was sort of looking at each other and going, okay, how do we structure this?
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, that's kind of classic New Zealand. I'm not sure there's anywhere else in the world you can kind of walk on into a regulator and sort of say, hey, this is what we think should work. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, well, why don't we do that then?
Because a lot of people probably assume that they're just there to apply rules, but really one of their mandates is to promote innovation.
Correct.
And that's exactly what you guys have done.
Yeah, and, they want an environment where people have the necessary protections and all that sort of good stuff, but that it doesn't throttle what should be something that's thriving.
Mm.
And look, it's high risk. You're never going to regulate away that risk. It is what it is.
Yeah.
So some things will go well and some things won't. And
yeah,
that's just the reality of it. And that's what's been happening in business since day dot. And
that's right.
Happy to forecast that it will continue.
Do you think that the interest rate levels overall, worldwide, not just in New Zealand, but the level of interest rates being so low worldwide has led to more funds being deployed in equity and specifically around this sort of space? Do you think that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of growth in this space?
Yeah, I think, you know, New Zealand is very much a yield market. You know, that's traditionally, we were talking before about property and that sort of thing. And, you know, most of the assets now, there's just no yield left in. That's all been priced out. So people are looking for some sort of return elsewhere. And, you know, for some people, investing directly into companies is just not their thing. There's in New Zealand still that perception around the 1987 share market crash and all that sort of stuff.
It's crazy, isn't it? We're still struggling to shake that hangover.
Yeah, that's right. More than 30 years ago and we're still thinking about it. But, you know, that's, you know, across asset classes, we've seen things bubble and pop. You know, there's probably more reticence in New Zealand compared to other markets about backing companies and investing in companies.
Right.
You know, you compare it to the US market where, I'm just going to say kind of cultural discussion around companies and investing and all that sort of stuff is just very different to New Zealand.
Here it's property. We're all about it. No risk at all. Safe as houses. But it's still very, very, the word immature is quite a negative word, but we're just not developed yet or we're not aware yet of that environment necessarily. Or, you know, that there is actually some good stuff getting outside of property and looking at whether it's shares or other direct investments.
That's right. And I think, you know, you probably follow what your parents did. I know I certainly was in that camp early on. My parents had invested in property and done okay out of it. And it was just sort of a natural thing to sort of go into. But, you know, if you were to look at most Kiwis' portfolios and sort of go, okay, well, how much should be in property? How much should be in international assets, how much should be in domestic shares and cash and bonds and all that sort of thing.
Correct.
You know, we're just so heavily skewed towards investment in property and a sort of diversification as well. I've got a house in Manukau and a house in Green Lane or something like that.
That's right,
And I'm well
diversified. Heavily diversified because I have two suburbs.
That's right. So that's kind of the Kiwi mentality. But it's not that across the market. You know, there's plenty of people that like the idea of exposure to companies. And I think the thing alongside, you know, potential returns that companies offers is that you're investing in people. Mm. You know, there's a motive element to it, that you're investing in people, you're investing in the future.
Mm.
And you want to have that relationship of being on that journey of the company growing and some of them going well and some of them, you know, ultimately tipping over. So, you know, there's also that other element that other asset classes don't necessarily give you.
And when it's actual startup businesses, if it's not you that's starting up the business, if it's not your idea, if it's not the journey that you're directly involved in, you can still get a piece of the action through, you know, what snowball effect do, because you're effectively presenting opportunities for people from the other side of the room to get on the bandwagon. You don't have to be a vegetarian to try the salad.
That's right. You exactly.
Know, everybody can get some of the action, right?
Yeah.
Or at least try it. Some people can kind of sense, well, maybe this is just me. I don't know. But it feels like New Zealand, inside the DNA of every Kiwi, is this ability to create something out of nothing and do it in a really innovative way and bring something out of nothing ex nihilo. I wonder if there's a bit of a revival in that space, partly because of cheap money, but also because of a big barrier to entry with that traditional asset class of property, where now they're looking at direct investment in startups as a viable mix for their portfolio. Do you see that this is a trend, or is this just a fad? What do you think?
I think it's something that people are gradually becoming aware of. So if we're just talking about, you know, the general public here, because I think there's probably two camps. There's sort of the general public who maybe haven't had the opportunity to invest in younger companies before.
Right.
So it's kind of, okay, I can do it this way. What does this mean? And I'm going to say, you know, there's a bit of a process, I think, over time of people becoming more educated around investing in younger companies. And what does it mean to own shares? And what are the rights attached to shares? And that sort of thing. So I think, you know, a growing education there. Then you get, you know, I'm going to say sort of high net worth people who, you know, are after just a greater array of companies in which they can look to invest in. You know, how do you get access to them? If you're, you know, a high profile person, I'm going to say like Sam Morgan or something like that, you know, he'll be throwing stuff all the time. He probably doesn't want to see too much more. But there's others with plenty of disposable cash who are like, well, how do I invest in this space? I've got 5 or 10% of my portfolio that I want to have here. Maybe I've got some expertise in this area. I've built a business, I've sold it. Wouldn't mind getting actively involved with a younger growing business, get on the board, be a mentor, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Do
you guys facilitate anything other than just the flow of capital? Like, is there more of a qualitative piece going on where there's a flow of human capital, where you're matching up people and helping people build their teams?
Yep. Yeah, so part of what we do is director placement. When someone signs up to Snowball Effect, they get invited to fill out an investor profile, and that just tells us a little bit about them. So it's a little bit like sort of your LinkedIn profile or something like that. You sort of tick some boxes and you kind of go, hey, this is me.
Yeah.
So what we're looking to do is understand the types of investments that people are wanting to make, as in what industries they like to invest in, what sort of check sizes do they like to write, and then, you know, to your point, you know, how they like to be involved. Do they just want to be passive? Do they want to be, you know, a director? They got something that they're wanting to contribute to those companies. And so when companies come to see us, sometimes they're wanting someone with a skill set or someone with a background to participate maybe in the capital raise, but more importantly, kind of be actively involved with the business.
Okay.
So we can do a search and sort of say, hey, okay, here's 10 people that we've got a short list of that we'll have a chat to about your opportunity.
Are there a lot of opportunities that find you guys? Like, is there a lot of people knocking on your door saying, hey, I've got this business, we're really early stage and we want to go to the next level, can you help us out? Like, at what stage should somebody, a founder, come to you seeking to raise capital?
Yeah, we normally say if they're doing less than $1 million of revenue, then it's just hard for us. You know, we have tried to place capital for those types of companies.
Like just hard to sell, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a challenge for us. So it's a challenge for us and it's ultimately a disappointment for the company. That's not true across the board. But if to sort of generalize, and I sort of said before that most of the investors that we work with, you know, kind of 3 to 5 million of revenue, that's starting to get interesting. Plenty south of that. I mean, we've certainly raised capital for companies doing less than $1 million. But yeah, if we were to kind of pitch it, that would kind of be it.
Yeah.
They may have done a capital raise before. They may already have, you know, a board of directors in place, all that sort of thing.
Yes.
So they're kind of established. They're up and going. They've kind of proven that there's a product that they can sell or a service that they can
they've done
get
the minimum
into market.
Viable product. It's
correct.
They're trading. Sure, the numbers aren't super massive, but it's quite clear. You can see that trajectory.
Correct.
And that's when you guys would step in and amplify what they're doing.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we're sort of looking at, you know, what's the growth to get there been? Has it taken them 10 years to get to $1 million? Or, you know, they sort of got there in, I don't know, 2 to 4 years. Depends on the types of company, what industry it's in and all that sort of stuff. But,
Do you see any further innovation that could occur in this space? And thinking across asset classes, do you see any other ways where innovation could occur using equity crowdfunding in particular?
Yeah, I think, you know, equity crowdfunding, as we were talking about before, it's a set of regulation that allows the general public to invest up to $2 million into a company.
Okay.
So, you know, it is reasonably restrictive in terms of the types of shares that people can offer. So that it is just share offerings. They can't make debt offerings or convertible note offerings, all that sort of thing.
So it's a very straightforward, plain vanilla.
Correct.
To share offering, yeah.
Yep. So I think, you know, the way we've seen innovation over the last few years really has been, I think, in what we can do. So we can couple a wholesale offer with a retail offer or an equity crowdfunding offer, which allows a company to raise more than $2 million.
Right.
And we're just saying, okay, well, what type of investor are you and what regulatory bucket do you fall into?
Let me pause you there. Just for our listeners, if we can explain the difference between, say, a wholesale or eligible investor versus a retail investor.
Yeah, cool. So yeah, retail investor, you know, that's someone who is probably new to investing, and I'm going to say mum and dad investor. That's your classic retail investor. Wholesale investor, there's a broad range of different things that make up being a wholesale investor, but basically it's someone who either has kind of the financial capacity to tick a couple of boxes or they're experienced in this space. So they may be someone who has a lot of experience in trading the share market and that sort of thing, and they can get an accountant or a lawyer to sign them off and say, hey, you've got the requisite experience to be an eligible investor.
And you would then have to prove that they went through that process. You hold documentation on them, which proves that you've actually vetted them out to make sure that they're not being taken advantage of or putting themselves in a high-risk position.
That's right. We have to get certification from them, or they can self-certify, depending on what criteria they meet. As they go through the investment process.
Cool. And let me just recap what I think I'm hearing here. So if you were a founder, you had a business which was trading around the area of $1 million and you could see a clear path of growth ahead of you, and you had perhaps restricted access to funding via debt or other means, then raising capital via snowball effect can be an efficient way to do so. Why?
I think the key thing for companies is we'll take them through a process of saying this is what position you need to be in to realistically raise capital.
Right. Position yourself so that you can attract
correct.
That capital.
And, you know, we'll go out there and we'll talk to investors on your behalf and say, hey, here's a summary of the opportunity. Is this interesting? And that is something that helps shape your offer on the way through.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, having your hand held in terms of how do I put together a document that is actually telling my story, articulating it clearly, and being able to present the case for investment to an investor.
Right.
And, you know, we'll work with companies who may already have investors that are interested, but they kind of go, actually, I don't really know what I'm doing here.
Okay.
You know, I'm just kind of out there. I've got a business which is growing really nicely, but are these people who are wanting to invest? You know, how do I go about that?
Okay. So you could actually help them, even in the negotiation of how much of the company they're going to get and how to structure it, you can do.
Yeah, so what we'll do is we'll act a little bit like an investment bank would, I guess, in terms of helping them structure up an offer.
Okay.
We can put them in touch with people if they're wanting to get a handle on pricing and valuation and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we don't do valuations in-house, but what we can do is help them find a market price.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of work before any offer around testing that pricing with investors just to say, okay, well, is this fair and reasonable?
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes companies, what's fair and reasonable is a fair way south of what a company thinks it's worth.
Yeah.
And that's just a process that companies need to go through.
Negotiation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the offers that you've done in terms of, you know, they've actually been finished. I know Squirrel, UBCO.
Yes.
Punakaiki, I know a few of them, but tell me if, just give me a couple of examples on how you've done that and where people are now. Because I'm curious to know what happens after the offer's made. I want to invest $10,000 in this. What happens? Take me through it.
Sure thing. I guess just to start off with a couple of companies that we've raised capital for, and I'll pick on some that people may know just to make it relevant.
Yeah.
So Invivo Wines, that's one that we've raised capital for twice. So one of our first ones that we raised in 2015, so we raised $2 million there. That was a public offer.
Okay.
So anyone could have invested in that. Yeah. And I think at the time they were probably doing about $3 million of revenue.
Yeah.
And they'd sort of just launched their collaboration with Graham Norton, that people may be familiar with.
Yeah.
And they've gone on and grown really well. Tim and Rob have done a great job there. They're sort of north of $13 million of revenue now.
Right.
They're one of the fastest growing wine brands in the UK. So the UK is their key market.
Right.
They're about to try and replicate what they've done in the UK and the US.
Wow. Okay.
So cool. In the UK, they've done a great job with the Graham Norton celebrity endorsement.
How did it work when they approached you?
So we were actually approached, I think, early 2015, and they were interested in making an offer. They actually had some people that wanted to invest.
Okay.
They had an offer that they were obviously wanting to make, and we said, look, we'll help you put together the offer and distribute it into the market. So they had those people there that would sort of set the terms of that offer and, you know, put in, I think it was $500,000 or something like that, but they were keen to raise up to two.
Okay.
And then it was about getting it out to our network, to their network and making sure that people knew there was an opportunity to put some money into Invivo Wines.
And so if I put in, $10,000 back in 2015?
Yes.
What would happen today if I wanted to sell it? What's the secondary market look like, if any?
So we facilitate just the sharing of details of people that are wanting to trade. So we'll have people that come and say, hey, I've got these Invivo shares for whatever reason I'm wanting to sell, change of circumstances or something like that. And we've got a list of people that we know are interested in buying.
So and we'll just connect informally those. Informally, you connect them. And
we'll just informally connect them. They can sort out the price.
Yeah.
We act as a share registry for the company.
Yeah.
So that's all done online. It's a nice simple tool that we've added in.
Yeah.
So we'll just take those shares, we'll transfer them over to the new owner.
Yeah.
And they'll have that reflected on their share register.
If I was investing via Snowball Effect, I'd be thinking, awesome, I've got access to companies now that there's no way I would otherwise get until a very, very later stage. And then the share price will accurately reflect everything because they would have matured. But I want to get on the ground floor. I want to get in before they go public. But that would be the one thing that I'd be concerned about would be this liquidity piece. What happens if I needed to, you know, get my cash out? Now, if I was only putting in, instead of $10,000, only $500, then it wouldn't be too much of a big deal. But the more you put in as a retail investor, the more you have to really consider your circumstances, because you'd hate to be committed to this thing for 10 years, really, before you get your money out, before it goes public, perhaps.
That's right. And, you know, that's one of the things that is very clear if you go on our website around, one, have investing money that you can afford to lose. So there's a risk component.
Yeah.
The other part is the illiquidity and being able to get your money out in a hurry. And, you know, we're looking at some opportunities in that space around being able to facilitate the exchange of of shares and doing that as a secondary platform.
Okay.
So that's something that hopefully next year we can...
Not
using blockchain. If we looked at blockchain, there's actually no real advantage in us using it. Not sure if you want to talk about that.
But yeah, why not?
Yeah, so I think...
Let's do an IPO. An ICO. That's right.
Yeah, so blockchain for us, because we own the registry, and so we've got the shares, you've got the registry where the shares are held, and then you've got the exchange. So if you're on the NZX, then they're different entities. So the whole thing around blockchain, just simplistically, is that you have complete transparency around the interactions within those different entities. Yeah. But because we've got all three of them, there's no real advantage to blockchain.
It's all in one circuit anyway.
That's right.
Yeah. Could you, for each offering that you do, could you create a token? And that's actually the thing that's being exchanged rather than shares in a company. Could you just exchange a token which points to an ultimate ownership vehicle?
Yeah, so there's a couple of groups that are doing that now in New Zealand, so Centrality. So they're doing some interesting stuff in that space. We've actually had one company go through, it was actually a private placement that we did, that they've ended up doing some blockchain stuff, and they're shortly going to be doing an ICO. Yeah. So the investors that we brought in, invested in equity, they've got shares in that company, and it's now moving on and hoping to do an ICO at some stage. Cool. So that's interesting to watch that one.
It is interesting to watch because it's kind of like, it's probably like equity crowdfunding to a certain extent, or that's maybe like a proxy for what will happen eventually with tokenization of assets. I think there's something in that because that's a way to raise funding.
Way to raise funding, yes. Yeah,
depending on what that thing is, whether it's a currency or a token or whatever.
Correct.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, so are there any other companies that you want to just talk about in terms of really cool success stories?
So UBCO, just to give people a little bit of background there, UBCO and an electric off-road bike, electric utility bike. Yeah. So they raised a very small portion of cash for us a couple of years ago. Okay. So it's about 400K or something like that. It was actually part of a wider round where they had brought in some family offices and some high net worths as well, but also wanted to make it available to the public.
Yes.
We're actually going to be doing another raise for them probably early in the new year to the public.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. We're just doing the private placement phase now. So hopefully get a couple of million there, and then there may be some more available for the public.
Yeah.
But they've progressed really well. When they came through us in their first round a few years ago, it was an early stage company. I'm going to say they were probably doing $1 million of revenue or might have been south of that.
Yes.
But now they're sort of $3 million plus in revenue. They've established their offices in the US and have, good sales and distribution into the US. They have a distribution team in the US and they work with a lot of suppliers and sales agents in the US. They're very focused on the adventure market.
Yeah.
They've grown, nicely, and they work with Real Journeys in New Zealand here, so down in Queenstown, Department of Conservation, those sorts of groups.
Of course, anywhere where you need to be driving around in stealth mode.
In stealth mode.
I love that concept, though. It's a two-wheel drive motorbike. It's cool.
Yeah, it sort of looks like a regular off-road bike, but it's electric.
Yeah.
Obviously there's the silence factor. But also this the weight factor as well. Yeah. They're a lot lighter than a 250cc farm bike.
Right, okay.
So in terms of chucking it on the back of the truck or lifting it over a fence or a gate or whatever it might be.
Right.
That's pretty simple. So it's kind of those practical applications as well.
Yeah. Now that's quite cool. And so there might be another opportunity for retail investors to get access early next year.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Like, what would be the ultimate end game from their perspective?
Yeah.
And using them as an example of other founders who are trying to go through this process and grow their business. How do they kind of get out the other side?
Yeah. So, and I'm making this up. This is me talking here.
That's right. This isn't agreed.
Yeah. That's right. So something like a Yamaha or a Honda or something like that. That wants to get into
or a Tesla.
Yeah. Or something that wants to get access to the market that they're in. Their main competitors really are the traditional bikes, the traditional farm bikes.
Mm.
So a company that's saying, hey, this is an interesting space for us to be in, Oftentimes we'll look to acquire a firm just to give them a leg up into that market. And we'll say, okay, well, we'll wrap our distribution and sales network around your product and we'll grow it exponentially as a result of that.
Yes.
So that's probably what I, like that would be suitable for a, know, an UPCO type bike. But there's probably, you know, I'm going to say 3 to 5 years of work that needs to be done to get
So if you were investing in that next year, let's say, you wanted to put some money into that, you might be looking at 3 to 5 years really before you're going to get the most out of your investment. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, that's right. And a lot can happen in 3 to 5 years in in a young business.
That's right. So having a long enough investment horizon with any of these opportunities is pretty wise, presumably.
Yeah,
because the higher the risk level, the longer your horizon should be. But acknowledging the fact that it's going to be high risk no matter what, because you're talking about startup businesses.
That's right. You know, that risk is always there, and it doesn't matter if you've got a whole bunch of high net worth people that have plowed some money in as well. It doesn't de-risk it. The risk is still there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, changing tack a little bit. We've had on the show, we've had Canna South a little while ago. And now that I think about it, actually, by the time this show gets published, it'll probably be ahead of that, so I won't say that.
So. Is that the cannabis firm, Canna South?
Yeah. So Canna South, they're planning on doing an IPO at some stage.
Right.
And previous to that, we've had Paul Manning from Helios come on the show, and he shared a little bit about how they raised capital for their venture. And I'm looking at overseas, thinking about what's happening in that sector, seeing a tremendous bubble that probably has just happened. We've just come on the other side of it, almost like a Bitcoin style bubble that's happened in the cannabis industry, that sector. But I'm wondering, in New Zealand, is it going to be, because we're slow to the party, I wonder if there's some wisdom that we're going to gain from that. And I wonder if there's going to be an opportunity for doing unique equity funding in that space. Do you see that could be something that you're going to see coming through Snowball more and more?
Yeah, we've been approached by a number of cannabis firms, some of the ones that people would be familiar with. It's all, for us, it's all a bit early stage. Because
and therefore
it is
quite high risk, because there's no actual revenue, right?
High risk. You know, there's still regulation that needs to go through. So there's no certainty that regulation will be there next year. There's a whole bunch of different models in the way that people are, the different companies, the different cannabis companies are pitching. So, you know, I think there'll be a bit of a shakeout. But, you know, there was actually a cannabis company, Hikarangi, who raised on Pledge Me. They did a capital raise, an equity capital raise. So that was an opportunity for people to invest. But, you know, it's all concept stage stuff at the moment.
It is, and it's kind of, if you look back at what you were saying before, where you prefer to be looking at companies around that at least $1 million in revenue, when you're talking about an industry which is in the shadows and it hasn't even, you know, the light hasn't been shone on it yet, it's highly, highly speculative and there's no revenue model yet.
That's right.
Well, there's a model, but there's no actual revenue.
No, you can only sort of use your reference points, you know, places like Canada or parts of the US, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But do you think, though, that there could be an opportunity, though, for a fund to start up that seeks funding via Snowball, for example, and that fund specifically invests in those startups to manage that risk a little bit better?
Yeah, possibly. It depends how it's structured, without sort of wanting to go down a rabbit hole conversation. But
no, that's right. I just want you to sign here.
Yeah.
I've got it all ready for you.
Yeah, so If the company, a lot of funds are structured as limited partnerships. So if they're a limited partnership, they can't, under the regulation at the moment, make an offer to the public. Puna Kaiki was able to because they're structured as a company.
Okay.
They're not a limited partnership.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about that. I think that is actually kind of interesting. Tell me the difference and the reason why that's relevant.
Yeah, so the regulation allows for companies to raise capital from the public under an equity crowdfunding license, but limited partnerships, they're not able to. Or anything that isn't just a vanilla company.
Right.
That company has to be New Zealand domiciled. So it's pretty straightforward, but anything that deviates outside of that, the FMA are quite strict on that.
And that's encouraging, because effectively that's going to be protecting the investor.
Makes sense. Look, it's just the starting point for regulation. They've sort of, let's not get too fancy. Yeah, you know, we might see some movement in that space over the next few years in terms of just opening up a little bit the types of structures that can raise capital.
Okay. Do you guys take a stake in the company?
Yeah, typically we don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, typically, you know, we'll work with the companies to get them ready and make sure they've got some good cornerstone capital.
Yeah.
In some cases, it's just that strategic placement that we're doing.
Yes.
But if they are going to the public, make sure they've got some good cornerstone capital in to, you know, set those terms to de-risk it from the company's perspective in terms of wanting to raise capital. I don't really want to just put it out there and hope that $1 million or whatever they're wanting to raise shows up.
Yeah.
That they actually have some certainty that people have looked at it, gone, yep, I'm going to put my money in, and I'm committed to this capital raise.
Yeah.
So that's our modus operandi at the moment.
Yeah.
Not saying that we wouldn't give other opportunities to investors or change the way that we operate
at all. Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Well, is there anything else that you want to go over? You know, any other sectors, actually, before I let you go? Are there any other sectors that you see coming up that are really interesting?
You know, we're sort of always guided by investors and what they want to invest in. And sort of the, I'm going to say, top five for our investors generally is sort of software.
Mm.
It's food and beverage.
Yeah.
It's biotech, clean tech type opportunities.
Yeah.
Energy related opportunities. And then a bit in the sort of health tech and med tech space.
Okay.
So quite diverse.
Mm.
But, you know, there's that kind of element of, I'm going to say, traditional business.
Yes.
There as well.
Gotcha.
Sort of that food and beverage manufacturing. I think a lot of people sort of feel that food and beverage is maybe an industry that New Zealand has
an affinity competitive with.
Advantage in.
Yes.
You know, being able to produce food and sell it to the world.
Yeah.
The
breadbasket concept.
The breadbasket.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Simeon, for joining us on the show. Really appreciate your time.
No problem.
And I'm sure that there's a lot of content there that our listeners will get a lot out of. So thanks again for sharing. And if you want to subscribe to the show, www.nzeverydayinvestor.com. Simeon, how can they find out more about what Snowball Effect are all about?
Just snowballeffect.co.nz.
Check it out.
Feel free to get in contact and happy to have you on to you.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks again.
Good one. Cheers. Thank you.
So thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. Thank you, Simeon and Snowball Effect, for your support and allowing us to do this show today. There's innovation happening in this space, isn't there? And it's exciting to see this because for everyday investors, we now have more access points to sharing in the success of startups. It could be really exciting. I'm personally really excited about this company called UBCO, as you could probably tell. I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to electric vehicles of all sorts, and UBCO is doing around, I think, early next year. So that's going to be really exciting. Now, it goes without saying that this is risky business, investing in startups. Don't invest any more than you're willing to lose. Usual disclaimers apply. None of this is financial advice, but check it out. It's a really interesting way to spice up your investment portfolio. Getting some of this alternative asset class could be just what you need to make investing a little bit more exciting. Now, if you want to find out a little bit more about Snowball Effect and how they work, check them out online. Just search for Snowball Effect. And if you haven't done so already, I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to the show. And if you feel generous, please give us a rating on iTunes or mention us on Facebook. Help us grow our audience. We're getting great feedback already. We'd like to continue doing what we're doing, so it would be really encouraging to know that we're reaching the right people with the right type of information. Awesome. So there you go. Hope you enjoyed, and we'll catch you next time around. You've been listening to the NZ Everyday Investor, brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. I've been your host, Darcy Ungaro. Please remember to subscribe to the show, and if you'd like to learn more about what we've covered today or any of our guests, please visit us on Facebook. The NZ Everyday Investor contains information and content designed to get you to think about your investment decisions, but none of this is financial advice. Thanks for listening in, and we'll catch you next time around.